Azrael with Ceres, the University of Colorado. Chris Clack and Aditya Chokalkar. The talk title is Wind Power Estimates from Numerical Weather Prediction Models Using Rotor Equivalent Wind Speed and the Full Power Equation. Chris?
Thank you, Bob. Good afternoon, everybody. So what I'm going to try and talk about today is looking at making some resource mapping using numerical weather prediction models, but incorporating the rotor equivalent wind speed so that we can look at wind shear in the vertical and look at direction shear as well. And the full power equation will become evident in a minute, which is something we derived. So just quickly, I want to go over the motivations. I think we all know them, which is that it's becoming ever-increasing use of wind energy over larger and larger geographic areas. And so to plan out for systems, which is part of what I'm doing as well, we want to be able to look at what the resources are for these big areas and how they interact with each other. And so if we can get the physics, I say quasi-right, of what's happening within these different regions, then we can hopefully plan out a bit better where to place the different generators. And what we can do is we can actually incorporate more information from the weather models than can be done traditionally. And so rather than just using the hub height wind speeds and using a power curve, you can start by using the density and using the CP curves. But then you can also look at different vertical levels and get more information about what's going on through the atmosphere as well. And so the rotor given wind speed is something that Wagner in 2009 came up with, which just looks at slices through the rotor area, and you can then work out what the shear is. And actually, with this same technique, you can work out what the direction shear is quite simply with weather models. And so what we wanted to do is try and put in as much information as we could and then see how that changes what the weather model would say if the resource is. I just want to talk a little bit about what the weather data that we actually used. We used the rapid update cycle assimilation model, and so we used a 0 hour of the model, so the optimal estimate of what the atmosphere is doing. And the reason we chose this is pretty simple, really. We use this complicated 3D VAR equation, which a lot of you may have seen. And this just takes the model and the previous background model, which is the previous hour forecast. And then we take the observations that come in. And because it was an operational model, there's an excess of 20,000 observations per hour that samples through the atmosphere. And so we wanted to bring that in. And I just wanted to leverage NOAA's capability of having all this put together with this background model to give us the optimal state of the atmosphere. And so we did this from 2006 to 2014, so we collected this data off mass storage with the full 3D fields. And again, why use the RUC and not use the RAP or the HER, which is the High Resolution Rapid Refresh? Well, the reason was that we knew that the rapid update cycle was going to be decommissioned and from operations in 2012. And to be taken over by the rapid refresh. And so actually the improvements in the model between 2006 to 2012 or 14 were not that great in terms of wind speed at hub height. They weren't working very hard to change those for hub height wind speeds because they knew the RAP was coming online and people in the wind industry were using the rapid refresh. And so we have an almost quasi-stable model to look at over those 9-year period. The next is that we wanted to make sure we use this hybrid isentropic sigma coordinate, and what that means is as you move towards more complicated terrain, the vertical levels will compress together to do more terrain following, and so you get some more vertical mixing happening near this terrain rather than just using isentropic. And so we wanted those two things coupled together. It's still at 13 kilometers though, so there are some things that we want to do further on with higher resolution. I just want to point out the concept, really. We've got the rotor area, which will sit in the model, and then we have these vertical segments that rise up through the rotor, and you want to be able to work out what the wind speed, the pressure, and the temperature is in each of these segments. And we only actually need the horizontal wind speeds because that's the only part that will actually go through the blades. And then this second term here, the UI, this actually works out the shear relative to the hub height. And so we assume that the hub is pointing directly into the wind for that height, and then the winds can obviously shear directionally above and below that. And so this takes into account that shearing across the blades. And then we can then use the terms in the bottom box down here that will allow us to work out the vertical shearing of the wind speed. So as the wind speeds increase with height, this will incorporate a weighted average for those different wind speeds. And we actually did the same thing for the density and for the temperature and for the clouds. And the clouds aren't important until you get to the higher hub heights, which you'll see in a minute. At the top here, we have the wind power estimate equation. And what I did here is I rederived it, but I actually used the discretized version rather than the instantaneous power. And so this first term here is what everyone recognizes as the wind power available. And these other terms are actually due to the fact that when we calculate in a numerical model the power output, it's always actually an energy. It's an average energy over a time period. And if you actually include these, this actually will change how much energy you're getting out from the system. And so the power has a little correction, two correction terms here, which is to do with density and wind speed change. And this comes out most importantly when there's ramps. And so when we're using hourly data, this term can be fairly large. Obviously, if it's a 20-second integration period, this term becomes much smaller. But it's still there, and when there's big ramps, this actually will have an impact. And I just want to point out that in the future, what we're hoping to do is put into here is the Reynolds decomposition, so we can look at turbulent intensity and how that plays out between density and wind speed deviations as well. And so these two plots, we've probably all seen these before, but the left is a capacity, the power capacity curve, and so it goes up to about 50% at around 7 or 8 meters per second, and then it drops off to when the turbines turn off. And we find that it's more accurate to use this with density and speed than just using the turbine power curve. And these should change per rotor segment. We assume that it's the same efficiency for each rotor segment, which is a big assumption, but we don't have any data to find out whether it is or isn't true. I suspect it's not quite true, because this is just the efficiency of it extracting the energy. And down here, you can't read it, but it'll be on the slides when they're available, is the different turbines that we use to calculate our generic turbines for each of the four classes. So we've got class 1, 2, 3, and then offshore as well. So on the top left here, this shows you what we did. We did different hub heights and different rotor diameters, and we wanted to do this because the technologies are always changing, and we want to see what the effect of changing the height and changing the rotor diameter will do to the wind speed estimates. There's obviously some that are missing because it doesn't make any sense to have an 80-meter hub height and then have a 160-meter rotor diameter, because you'll be killing people, which would not be very good. And so we also did the same thing. We didn't want to go below 20 meters. And so in total, we have about 152,000 data points geographically, and then we have 74,000 time steps, which are hourly time steps. And the 6% that's missing is just because the an operational usage, just sometimes the cycles didn't complete. And so on the bottom left here, what we did was we took a site which was in Washburn, Texas, which was publicly available for the whole period that we were looking at, and we compared the modeled wind speeds at 100 meters at this assimilation hour, and then the observed wind speed at the tower. I think it was a sonic anemometer that measured them on the tower. It may have been a cup anemometer, but I need to check that. But each one of these is actually a cross, which is a data point for each of the time period. And this black line here would be a one-to-one relationship. And my hope was that every single blue cross would lie on that line. I was pretty certain it wouldn't, but it does lie on a line. But the line is slightly skewed, and we can see there's a bias here. So at high wind speeds, it doesn't pick up all the high wind speeds, and at low wind speeds, it's a little bit high. And on the right here, all I wanted to do was plot the wind speed observed versus the wind speed estimated. And this is something that we're always working on, or always competing with, is this is a grid cell average over 13 kilometers, whereas this is a point measurement. And so what you see here is you don't see the speed-up effects that happen at this site, where this wind speed, it catches the ramp going up, but it doesn't continue all the way up to the speed that it was measured at. But you can see that it is generally following the physics, and hopefully as we get to higher resolution models, this will improve. So what does this show? We have the hub heights here, and what I wanted to just show here is the different classes with different hub heights. Green means that it's IEC 3 class, orange is class 2, and black is class 1. And this cross on here on each of the plots shows where we do some validation and some stuff later on. But as you can see, as you expect, as you move higher, your classes will increase all the way up to 160 meters, which is the limit we went to, where we cover what Dr. McDonald talked about earlier. This high plains region is now entirely covered by IEC 2, whereas at 80 meters, there's none really in that area. What does that mean for average wind speeds? Well, this is just the average wind speed at these hub heights. So this is looking at the average rotor equivalent wind speed. So we're not looking at hub height wind. We're looking at the rotor equivalent wind speed with a 100-meter rotor. And what you'll see here is as you go higher again, you can see that the wind speeds do increase, and they increase in different areas at different speeds. And what I like to see is that as you go in the southeast, as you go to higher and higher hub heights, you'll see that there's some regions now that get pretty good average wind speeds. And what that means is, and you can see that the offshore does change as well, but not as dramatically, which is a good sign. What that means for power is that anything below 20% we ignore and make it transparent. And as you can see, as you move higher and higher, the percentage of the US that doesn't have over 20% capacity factor increases. And indeed, you get regions where you get up to 50% capacity factor as well on the high plains. But offshore, again, you see it's in the red, which is well over 50%. And so the rotor equivalent wind speed, actually what that does is it reduces the average power on land, but increases it very slightly offshore. And again, this is showing 160 meter, you now get some onshore, which is as high as offshore. This shows you the difference with rotor diameter. And what you can see in these four is these are different. These are the same hub height, 100 meters, but you've got the four different rotor diameters here. And it's very, very slight, but you can see a lightening of the colors between these browns to these browns. And this is because as you incorporate more and more shear, you're actually reducing the power output from your turbine because of the average power output. Your power is going up because you've got a larger turbine, but your percentage is going down. And this could be reversed when we take into account turbine intensity, because that can increase the amount of power you're getting out at low wind speeds, which could be helpful. So quickly, I want to go over some differences. So this is the whole 9 years. We're looking at the average difference between the rotor equivalent wind speed and the hub height wind speed power. And as you see, as we go higher, we're just looking at the negative scale this time. I haven't shown the positive scale. As you go higher, you actually reduce the difference between the rotor equivalent wind speed and the hub height wind power. And what actually happens here is, when I show on a later plot, these actually go positive. So as you go higher, the rotor equivalent wind speed actually increases your power. And what you can see in some regions here, you get some big dramatic differences, 6.5% loss in energy. And we wanted to investigate where that happens. And unfortunately, when this happens is summer. You lose a huge amount of power in summer in these regions when you look at the rotor equivalent wind speed, which is not great when you consider that's when you really want to get the power from the rotor equivalent wind speeds. But you can see as you go higher and higher, this effect diminishes. Semi to last plot. This is looking at the time of day on this axis, and I'm sorry it's not very clear. This is the day of the year on the x-axis, and on the y-axis is the hour of the day. So we're looking at a whole year here. At 100-meter hub height on this one, and then 120-meter hub height to the right, 140 to the bottom left, and 160 to the bottom right. And they're all with 120-meter rotor. And we get an increase in power overnight. So there's sort of a convex curve here and another one here, and you get large increases in the middle of the night. And these dark blues here are when there's data missing. And as you go up, you get this increase where it happens at night and diminishing during the day. But then as you pass through that layer, you actually move to a constantly increasing amount of energy. And that looks like it's due to the profile of the wind speeds. The penultimate slide is, we're looking now at the full power equation versus the rotor equivalent wind speed here. So we're changing slightly. And with the full power equation, over land, you get no big differences over the whole nine-year period. But you do get some differences over the water, and we're still trying to investigate why that would be that you still get these differences over water. But it is small. It's about 5% over the water. But what's very interesting is on an hourly basis, this is a range between 25 and minus 25%. You get these huge events where you're generating a lot more electricity than you think, or we could be, and you get in large regions where there's less. And this is just moving the timing of the ramps, and we're looking at whether we now have lots of data, thanks to Excel, to look at whether this is actually correlating well with the power outputs that they're seeing, because they do see some very differences to the models that they have got. So to conclude, we've produced this demonstration set where we're looking at, can we apply this to other higher resolution models? And the plan is to do it for 3 years, between 2012 and 2014, with the RUC, the RAP, and the high resolution rapid refresh. And so we can look at the difference between models and the difference with resolution. We're going to also then look at the full power equations versus actual measurements of power. And then the third thing we could do is include turbulent intensity into these equations and see how that affects the power output and the downstream effects as well. So thank you for your time.
Thanks, Chris. We have time for questions. Anybody? I was wondering about, so you were pointing out that the difference between the rotor equivalent wind speed and a hub height wind speed is generally that the power is reduced for rotor equivalent. Presumably that would be a function of the profile shape, and if it was a linear profile, then they'd be about the same, or what are the factors that are involved there?
Yes, that's true. So to get a difference with the theory, you have to have something that's not linear or constant. If it's linear, then the weighted averages will balance out, and so to get a reduction, you're through the rotor swept area, you have to have, as you decrease height, it has to accelerate faster to a slower wind speed. And so at low, moderate to low heights, this curve gives you a reduction in speed. But then when you get higher, because of the shape of the curve, you actually get an increase in power because you're moving the tips of the blade up to much faster wind speeds than were below. And so it's what we're trying to find out is where you want to place your turbine to minimize the torque on the blades as well as increasing power from the rotor blades as well.
Go ahead.
So I'm working with I'm working with Aditya, one of my colleagues, to look at LiDAR measurements and tower measurements through height to validate how good the shear profile is. And we haven't done that yet, but that's something we really want to look at because over a 13-kilometer grid spacing, we think it's not going to be great. But that's why we're doing that 3-year comparison between these different models to see if we're progressively getting closer or not. So yeah, definitely true.
Other question? Just what you mentioned that you thought that turbulence had the possibility of offsetting the shear effects. How does that work?
So the turbine intensity increases the amount of energy available in general because you're just adding energy somewhere. And so the question is whether you're adding that energy through the rotor plane or you're adding it vertically and moving it away from the rotor plane. And it appears from other studies that at low wind speeds, you're actually adding energy through the rotor plane, but then as you go to higher wind speeds, when you're getting close to that flat part of the power curve, you're only getting the negative components of the turbine intensity. So as you go into the flat part of the curve, you add energy, but you're not capturing that energy because you're already at full power. But when it reduces down energy, you lose power, whereas at the low part of the power curve, the opposite is true. When you lose power, it doesn't matter because there's nothing really generating, but when you gain power, you add energy. And so Those factors need to be played into the power curve and the CP curve to see how the energy transfer is happening.
We have time for another one if somebody's
brave.
Got it. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Chris.